Hi, I'm Sam Cedar.
And I'm Emma Vigeland. This week on Ring of Fire, I speak with Jeff Stein of the Washington Post, the White House economics reporter, who I talk to about stimulus talks, the liability shield, and potentially checks being sent out under President Biden and all the plates that are spinning with the Georgia Senate race.
And of course, we will run down the biggest stories of the week with Heather Digby Parton. If you're listening to the free podcast right now, do us a favor, support the program. You can help us out by becoming a member over at rofpodcast.com. Now here to break down this week's news, Heather Digby Parton from Salon and the popular blog Hullabaloo. So, Heather, here we are. The this week has been absolutely devastating in terms of COVID. It is going to get worse. It is probably where we should start our conversation today because, you know, it is we lost over 3,000 Americans on Wednesday of this day, breaching the 3,000 mark, Wednesday of this week, I should say. And frankly, I mean, folks can do these numbers at home. All you need to do is look at what the infections were today, whenever you're hearing this, multiply that number by 1.4%, put it into your calculator, 0.014, and you will know what the low end of the death rate will be, of the deaths will be anywhere from 16 to 21 days from that day that you're calculating. And it can go up as high as 1.8%. It could even be higher because we are now hitting, as you know, Heather, places around the country where our medical system is simply overrun, where we do not have the beds, but really that is just simply a vernacular way of saying we don't have the staff to deal with all the people who have been hospitalized. And this is only going to get worse. It won't get better until we start seeing the infection rates go down, and they're not going down. They're still, shooting upwards. And this is, I mean, it's a horror show.
Well, there's no doubt about it. I live in California, and in Southern California here and a couple of other regions, we're on stay-at-home orders again, just like we were last spring. They're a little bit more, generous in terms of you can go outside, you can go to the beach, and they've got hiking trails open. They didn't shut absolutely everything down. But yeah, we're back where we were, and it's kind of terrifying. You know, I know you went through that in New York, and you know, there are small towns all over America that are going through this. But it's, you know, it's a scary thing. I mean, they're at a point where they're down below the threshold that they set for how many ICU beds had to be available before they were shutting it down, and we're there. And there are a lot of people. I mean, the death rate right now is, you know, it's horrifying. We're having a 9/11 every single day, basically. And, you know, that's not even counting the excess deaths, the people who have what they call excess deaths. They're people who wouldn't have died of other causes during, if COVID wasn't present, because they would have gone to the hospital or there would have been a quicker response by an ambulance or those kind of things that they figure happen, you know, when you have a health crisis like this. So, you know, we are in deep, deep trouble, and it's not getting any better. It's getting worse. And, you know, you've got things like, I mean, this is one of the things that really just kills me about all this. You know, Rudy Giuliani got it this past week. I don't know how he'd avoided it up to now, other than maybe he's, you know, half embalming fluid or something. But he gets it, and, you know, he of course, goes to the hospital. As he puts it, my doctor said, we'll get you in the hospital, we'll get you treated, we'll get you out in 3 days because, you know, we've got these treatments. Well, these treatments are not available to most people. Most people don't have access to that stuff.
To virtually anybody. I mean, I would imagine these are available to, you know, 0.01% of the country. Yeah. These are the wealthiest or most connected people in the country.
Yeah, and it's a tiny group of people. They get this, you know, these treatments, which clearly are pretty darn good, right? I mean, look at what we watched, what happened with Donald Trump, and we're seeing it happen with Giuliani and with Ben Carson and all the people who are connected, and I'm sure there are a lot of other rich people who are getting that, a tiny percentage of the population, but, you know, a fair number of them. And it's just enraging, right? I mean, we're seeing people dying. These stories that you're hearing, the overwhelming fatigue and burnout that's happening to the healthcare workers, the frontline workers who are dealing with this stuff, ambulance drivers who are, you know, they're working 7 days a week. They don't have enough ambulances. They don't have enough people. I watched a whole story about the 911 system being overwhelmed all over the country. I mean, this is, you know, again, it's just another one of those illustrations of, you know, the inequality in our, you know, in our country. And of course, let's not forget that the people who are suffering the most from all this, gee, big surprise, happen to be Black and Brown,
right.
Native American. You know, that those groups are being hit tremendously hard. If nothing else, we've seen the inequities in our healthcare system when it comes to race and ethnicity. So, I mean, this is just, it's just getting worse and worse and worse. It feels like, in terms of the reality on the ground, right? Now, obviously, we have this great news about the vaccine, the vaccines, I should say, that are on the horizon. But in the meantime, you know, we're hitting the worst part of the pandemic. And, you know, there's this thing, and I feel it as I'm sitting here in a place where it's exploding, thinking, I'm just going to sit here in my house. I'm not going anywhere.
Right.
I do not want to be the last person to die of COVID before I could get vaccinated. You know, I mean, that
right.
kind of, that the last soldier to die in a war. You know, the idea that people are still dying with this, you know, this help on the way, and just knowing that if we'd have handled this better, if we'd have had a better, you know, response to the crisis, that a whole lot of those people that are dying every day probably wouldn't die because we handled it better than we did. I mean, just the mask wearing nonsense alone has killed an awful lot of people, and that you can look at the very top, you know, to blame for that kind of thing. So, you know, here we are, you know, heading for Christmas, and, you know, Fauci says it's going to be a surge upon a surge, you know.
Yeah.
Just, it's terrifying.
It is terrifying. And you did mention that, you know, the vaccines this week on Thursday, the FDA advisory committee was meeting on the vaccinations on Pfizer. We should say Canada and Great Britain have already started to distribute it. Presumably, they're doing it in, you know, similar fashion that we are. However, and this came to light this week, and, you know, I feel like there's still been underreporting on this, and there has not been, you know, I'm trying to wrap my head around it, but it appears that the American government placed six bets on six different companies to create vaccines, reserved 100 million doses from each. That is 50 million people. Six times 50 is 300 million, which I think everybody can sort of, I mean, right there, you can see there's some type of problem. Now, AstraZeneca, for whatever reason, the government put ordered 300 million doses approximately, which would have been 150 million people. But you can see the problem there is that, of course, that you're only a winning bet only gets you 50 million doses of an effective vaccination. And this is about, you know, reserving things. And I don't know how much the vaccine is going to cost at this point for a government, but we're talking maybe billions, right? I mean, I don't think we're talking 10 billion per. I mean, maybe we're talking 10 billion for all. But I mean, contemplate this for a moment. We just spent $740 billion the Congress approved for defense. And the long and short of it is, because of how parsimonious the bets, essentially, our government placed, we may not be getting vaccination. We may not even be able to start to get the second round of vaccinations until June of next year, when various other, most other Western countries anyways, have already fully vaccinated their entire populations by far, because they went all in. And for whatever reason, the Pfizer people came out and said, like, you know, we told the government, like, even closer to when we thought it was going to be safe, buy another 400 million doses. And we didn't. Now, I, for the life of me, aside from the enormous incompetence of this administration, I can't, well, I want to say I can't imagine why, but it would be hard pressed to think that it wasn't because Donald Trump has a friend who's associated with AstraZeneca, or somebody has a friend who's associated with AstraZeneca, or, you know, who knows exactly. But the idea that it was just like an honest mistake or whoops, I mean, this is just insane, that they should have bought 200 or 300 million, you know, they should have bought 300 million doses of each. You know, that would have been 150 million people at the very least. It would get you up to, you know, half of the country at the very least would be able to be immunized right off the get. And we're not. It seems like this story is not getting the attention it deserves.
It isn't getting the attention it deserves. And I don't think we know at all yet what the real story is here. And I have the same suspicions you do. I think everybody does. I mean, when we heard that Pfizer story last week that, you know, they had offered this and nobody really understands why they didn't take it. And everyone said, no, I don't know. You know, gee, did that happen? And, you know, all of that seems very, very suspicious that something, you know, very odd was going on there. But consider this, too. You know, you're talking about big money. Of course, we all knew that Operation Warp Speed was, you know, they were laying bets across the board, and they were, because they wanted to have, you know, them to be able to, you know, get their manufacturing up and ready to go the minute the vaccines were working. They didn't want to have a delay.
Even if the vaccines turned out to be, and the risk would be, the vaccine didn't work. We've spent all this money in its production. Okay, so we lost that bet. But, I mean, come on.
But yeah, I mean, the idea was sound to just say, look, we're going to put it all in on this. You guys go do your R&D and get this thing up and running, do the trials, and be prepared. We're going to put enough money out there for you to be prepared to manufacture immediately the doses that we're talking about. So I got that. I thought it was kind of unusually, you know, smart of the Trump administration to actually go along with that kind of thing. But of course, you know, what we're seeing also is the very real possibility that they were laying some other bets too, if you know what I mean. Some financial bets on behalf of some people. And that's one of the reasons why this is so weird. And what you're saying to, you know, there's also a sense that maybe, you know, they were just they didn't want to spend the money to, you know, put these orders in because, you know, there was a belief at this point in the middle of the summer. You know, this is when Atlas started coming in and they were saying, hey, you know, don't worry, this thing's going away, and that Trump didn't want to, you know, deal with the vaccine. I mean, we don't really know yet, and I hope that somebody gets to the bottom of it. And even more importantly, you know, one of the big things about this whole issue of the vaccines is all the rich Western countries and China and Russia and some of the others who have their own vaccines. They're already distributing. You know, they're going to get vaccinated, but the poor part of our planet is not going to get vaccinated. So I would have thought, at least not right away, I'd have thought the U.S. would say, look, let's order all this stuff. We'll over order. We will get our people vaccinated. You know, of course, they're going to vaccinate Americans first, but have all these other vaccines, you know, have the other vaccines ready to go to ship to the third world so that, you know, this is sub-Saharan Africa. Places like that need to be vaccinated, too. So we could have done that and done something decent for the world by sending our excess vaccines, if that's what they were, to places where they're going to need it and they don't have the money. But of course, you know, we couldn't do that. So I could just see them sitting there with a spreadsheet going, well, I don't know, 350 million people. Let's not go overboard. You know, let's not order any more than we need, you know, that kind of thing, even ignoring the fact that the whole planet needs these vaccines and that we're rich enough to be able to help with that. Hopefully the Biden administration and the new, you know, the new Congress will start thinking about that, because, by the way, you know, the virus doesn't care you know, this sounds a cliche, but, you know, it doesn't observe borders. There's going to be people coming in with it. It's going to be much harder to contain if we don't vaccinate as much of the world as possible.
And I would just add, we are also actively inhibiting the ability of Iran to purchase vaccinations because of our embargo. I mean, it's just it's a war crime as far as I'm concerned.
It's a crime against humanity.
Yeah.
That is grotesque. I didn't actually know that. That's awful.
It's awful. And so, hopefully this is something that on day one, Joe Biden rolls back. I mean, you know, obviously there's a lot to be done to get us back into that agreement with the Iranians. But this is something that is a no-brainer. You just do it. Let's turn from that. I mean, when we reconvene next week, we're just going to have the same thing to say about COVID, except for the numbers are just going to be higher.
Yeah.
And the deaths are going to be higher. And hopefully, and this is what's sort of stunning. You know, this week, I think Wyoming came out with a mask mandate. Hopefully, we will get to the point where we see these states that are been in raging denial will at the very least start to implement these things. But of course, you know, the problem is that you can do a mask mandate. But if your population has come to the conclusion because they've been watching the president and they're so they put their faith and their trust in the president that masks are just a hokum. I mean, I don't know how you enforce these things. Obviously, you can do it in a restaurant. You can shut the restaurant or you can do it in a supermarket. But you can't enforce it in people's homes. You can't enforce the way that people behave at this point. And almost it feels like the ship has sailed on trying to get people to take the thing seriously. And you know, one of the big problems, of course, is that we don't know. You know, it's not like on the front page of the paper that Amarillo, Texas has, I don't know, at this point, like a 2% ICU capacity. That's not going to be on the front page in the national news. This is localized. The problems are going to be localized in aggregate. Obviously, it's a horror show, but our system of information dissemination is not terribly effective in these type of situations. I just don't know how there's going to be any type of real response. And so I'm afraid that, you know, next week when we reconvene, we're going to say the same thing about these numbers. They're just going to be higher and we're just not going to see that much of an attempt to mitigate them. And I don't know when that comes. I mean, I really don't. It's really, it's shocking. And then the other sort of shocking element to this has been the fact that we are now 8 months into this, 9 months into this, and we have not had any type of economic relief for 7 months. And we are now about 2 weeks away from 12 million people losing their unemployment insurance. We are about 2 weeks away from 12 million people, maybe a little more, losing protection on an eviction moratorium. At the end of January, the moratorium on having to repay your student loans, interest and principal, will stop. We have cities and states that are basically, you know, broke. We have no money to create the mechanisms to distribute this vaccine. this is insane. And we have a compromise bill. I mean, this really puts lie to a lot of the narratives that we've heard. We have a compromise bill, right? I mean, it's a highly compromised bill, I should say. Between a gang of four, I guess, or a gang of eight. I'm not quite sure how you calculate these numbers. But Republicans and Democrats, we can get into the details of the bill. It's not a great bill, but it is something. Mitch McConnell's killing it. And I mean,
well, that tells you something, doesn't it?
Well,
I mean, the fact that McConnell is killing this kind of, you know, tepidly, you know, barely, you know, useful bill that they've cobbled together here, and he's killing that too. The Grim Reaper is, you know, he is, you know, an evil person. There's just no doubt. I saw Katie Porter on TV this week. She was talking about, you know, the fact that she's, you know, talking about the fact that Mitch McConnell, you know, you go through all of this, you get the, you know, everybody is compromising all over the place. People are trying desperately just to get something out the door. And the only thing he cares about, it seems pretty obvious here, is this liability for corporations. And he really does not want to help states and local governments. He just, those two things have been the sticking point for him. Or, you know, or of course, who knows? Maybe everything's a sticking point. Maybe he's just using that as an excuse. I don't even know. But for whatever reason, this guy does not want to do this thing. And I don't know if he wants to cripple Joe Biden, if he just hates humanity. I don't really understand the motivation. He's got a bunch of right-wingers in his caucus who are going to, you know, they're not going to vote for anything because they're as crazy as the Freedom Caucus in the House now. They've completely lost all bearing, you know, all normal kind of behavioral, you know, humanity. But, you know, there's something really, really, you know, I don't know what other word to use other than evil about him. And the way that he has dealt with this particular issue. And here we are coming to the very, very end. I mean, this is ridiculous. I mean, this has been going on for months. And the country is, the economy is in desperate shape. This isn't, you know, this isn't just some, you know, mild recession or something. This is it. The people are going to be evil.
Well, there were stories this week of there have been like record numbers of shoplifting of food. The country. I mean, he doesn't care. But let me ask you this, okay? Because I don't know what there is for the Democrats to do at this point. But how predictable is this?
Yeah, of course.
I mean, it was highly predictable. And
this is, you know, like, I understand.
Have you met Mitch McConnell?
Well,
do you know,
exactly.
You know? Like, do we not know who he
exactly.
is?
Exactly. And here's Katie Porter. She is calling out Mitch McConnell. She did it on a tweet. I imagine she did it on television. I saw a clip of her this week saying, this is not even stimulus. This is like a rescue package. This is desperately needed. Yet, and you know, I know I sound like a broken record with this. I don't know that there's anything different that can be done now. But we are here in this moment because of two things. One, a Republican Party who care nothing about other than maintaining power or debilitating other people having power.
Yeah.
But in a completely and thoroughly predictable way. Like in a completely non-surprising to the point where, you know, like, you know, people were laughing at Joe Biden, hopefully, when he said their fever is going to break when Donald Trump is gone.
Right.
That is a fact. The leadership of the Democratic Party has not come to grips with that fact, has either not come to grips with that fact, has been and as such has been thoroughly incapable of dealing with it, or has no interest in coming to grips with that fact because of their own agenda. It really doesn't matter which one of those twos are. The fact is that they have been completely ineffectual. And now I don't know what differently Nancy Pelosi could do today. I certainly know what she could have done differently in March or late or early April when that first, that second tranche of the PPP came up. She could have used that leverage. But just this week, Katie Porter is on television saying, this is not stimulus. This is a desperate need by the American public. Katie Porter, incidentally, obviously comes from a purple district. She turned it blue. So it's not like she's not coming from the Bronx. Let's put it that way.
Right.
Okay. Nancy Pelosi, the very next day, is holding a press conference saying, the reason why we don't need to go after $2 trillion, or justifying why she didn't take the $1.8 trillion deal that was on the table from the administration, which, in my estimation, it could have been the most garbage deal in the world, but it would have created a fissure between the White House and the Mitch McConnell in the days leading up to the general election, which would have been very helpful. The reason why she said that was because Joe Biden's president. I mean, just like for a moment, contemplate what she's saying here. She is undercutting and it's not her job to support Katie Porter's message, but which one has more resonance? The one that the American public is suffering desperately, they need desperate help, or two, like, it's not so desperate anymore because Joe Biden's president. What? How does that work? Like, what?
He's not president.
Well, A, he's not president. He's not president for a month and a half.
Expire at the end of this year. Joe Biden's not going to be in there.
And Joe Biden doesn't have the ability, unless he has the Senate, and even then, who knows, to sort of turn this around magically. Like, there's no story even as to why. Like, I'm sorry, this is very cynical, but I'm quite convinced that she didn't support that $1.8 trillion because they were afraid that Donald Trump was going to get credit for it, and that would hurt them in the general election. Now, that's, I don't know, I can't prove that. But I also can't prove that it would have hurt Trump or not hurt Trump. But the only thing I can prove is that where we are today, and that much of this, all of it, was horribly, horribly, desperately predictable.
Well, and you know who it might have helped? Where it might have helped all those frontline, Congress people of hers that she was so concerned with. That lost.
Yep.
Maybe a rescue package that had come through and they could run around taking credit for putting money in people's pockets, et cetera, might have helped them. So, you know, in the sense of even in the most crude, cynical, you know, sort of calculation, that was a bad calculation.
Yeah.
I think. Because
yeah,
there's
horrible.
Been a lot of discussion about how, you know, one of the things that Donald Trump, that people did give Donald Trump credit for putting money in their pockets and for trying to get the economy open and doing that sort of thing. There was a lot of that. And who knows, maybe, and it was in those kinds of, you know, the places where he won. People were kind of saying, hey, you know, that $1,200 came in handy, or I've got $600 extra in my pocket each week than I would have. So, you know, maybe, I mean, that was a poor calculation on her part, because putting money in people's pockets is something people can run on. And yes, Donald Trump could have run on it too, but so could her, you know, her people. Now she's got a much smaller
yep.
margin, and it's going to be a lot tougher. And speaking of leverage, by the way, they just passed a huge, you know, military authorization bill. There's leverage. The
right.
House of Representatives has, is they can't pass it without them. And I thought, why did they let that one sail through? But they're still haggling over this other stuff. And they're haggling over the government, you know, the regular appropriations, too.
Yep.
I mean, they had to do a week extension here in order to even get that done. And they're haggling over all that stuff. You know, the House has power. And I don't see them willing to use it in a way that would help people in the middle of an incredible crisis. I mean, look at the lines of cars that line up for food
yep.
distribution. I mean, this is happening all over the country. It's happening here in Los Angeles. And you see, you know, people are lining up for miles to get, you know, food handouts. So, I mean, this is desperate. I guess that my point is that this is a desperate situation that requires desperate, you know, it requires going out on a limb to try and get it done. And I'm just not sure. And McConnell seems... Maybe he'll give in at the end. You know, maybe he's playing some kind of a game and saying, well, you know, trying to appease his, you know, wingnut faction that doesn't want to spend any money at all. Maybe that's the game he's playing. But we can't know that. And the only thing we know now is that we're coming up, I mean, we're 2 weeks away from a bunch of people being evicted, losing their unemployment insurance, being, you know, left destitute in the middle of a pandemic, where they're not supposed to leave their house. and they have, you know, nowhere to go, no food, no job, no anything. I mean, it couldn't be worse, right? I mean, this is like the worst of all possible worlds,
right,
for a lot of people. And, you know, I don't know what kind of game they're playing, but I agree with you that Pelosi's comments that, well, we have, you know, everything's okay now, help is on the way, you know, that kind of thing is really not helpful at all. And
it's also just like, I mean, aside from it being morally reprehensible, I like, where is the political advantage in this? Like, okay, let's assume that nobody hears what she says. Well, it won't do any damage. But if I'm sitting in Georgia and I'm wondering, should I go out and vote? Oh, there's no urgency. There's no urgency. I don't, but, you know, I mean, like, well, like, why is she going out and even opening her mouth? Because there is no way that that is helpful. And it's not like the whole country would be clamoring, why isn't Nancy Pelosi coming out and giving a statement today? I mean, honestly, like, if you're going to put out a message, why, like, where does this, who does this help? It only is defending her position. If I'm sitting in Georgia, which right now is the most consequential vote, you know, election day that we've had probably, I mean, you know, aside from Biden's election, it's the most consequential election that, you know, we've had in I don't know how long. And in decades, maybe. I mean, it's going to, in terms of like the material implications for people, it's going to be huge. And she's out there saying that there's no urgency anymore, that we know that, that like that at least, you know, $1 trillion worth of urgency, $2 trillion worth of urgency is gone. I mean, I just don't understand. And what just sort of baffles me is that, like, there doesn't seem to be any sort of reaction from institutions, from writers. Like, I mean, there doesn't seem to be a tremendous outcry at this. And this just seems to be absolutely not. You know, one could make the argument like, well, none of this matters, right? Whatever Nancy Pelosi says doesn't matter. Whatever she does doesn't matter. None of it matters. All right, well, then let's just get somebody in there who is, I don't know, younger and can make the phone calls. I mean, like, you know, like if none of it matters, then none of it matters. But if any of it matters, then that what she's doing is wrong. She's just failed time and time again. And there is a real problem we have with Democratic leadership. I mean, you write about Joe Biden's perspective this week on this whole, you know, the fever's going to break thing. And, you know, at times I thought, okay, maybe he doesn't really believe that, or maybe he's gotten over that and that delusion. There was an audio released by The Intercept this week, apparently, of a phone call, you know, like a Zoom call between some civil rights leaders and Joe Biden, where he almost unprompted took the opportunity to say, like, I'm not doing any of this executive order stuff. That's all unconstitutional. Or executive action even is unconstitutional. I mean, first off, no, it isn't. second off, like, you know, like, what, like, what, you know, I don't know, maybe you could at least argue at least that makes Georgia important, and so maybe that's a smart thing to say. I don't know, but
well, he didn't say it in public.
No,
so it's not like that would make a difference. You know, I mean, he said it in private, which says to me that he means it.
Right.
I mean, that he actually thinks this, and you know, I did write about that this week. This whole, you know, there's a tremendous pressure building, and I predicted this. I know you did too. We all knew this was going to happen. The idea of, you know, hey, let's let bygones be bygones, and don't look in the rearview mirror, and all that stuff. The same thing that happened with Obama. There's a tremendous establishment pressure to do that, and there's also something that comes from the media, and we're starting to see that happen as well. People like Ken Vogel, you know, pimping the Hunter Biden story, that sort of thing, which is saying to Democrats, hey, look, you know, you have to live by, you know, these rules and norms, because you made a big stink out of it. And if you don't, you know, we're going to come down hard on you for being hypocrites. And of course, Democrats are terrified of being called hypocrites. Nothing could be worse in their minds than being, you know, revealed as being hypocritical. Well, you know, that's what Joe Biden is dealing with there. That's what he's saying, which is, I don't want to be a hypocrite. I think it's unconstitutional to do this. Well, he doesn't know that. These things haven't been litigated. The idea of an executive, you know, order, whether or not they, you know, in various circumstances.
And to be clear, executive order and executive action, two different things. Executive action relies on just simply taking action based upon pre-existing statute. Right.
You know, that's the job of president, is to take executive action. And, you know, I mean, otherwise, what's he doing? I mean, you know, I guess appointing people. And, you know, that's ridiculous. And the thing is that, you know, one, the thing that I'm most concerned with and have been for a long time, Joe Biden or any other Democrat coming into this, would be that there's a tremendous institutional pressure within the party, within the establishment, and among the media. First of all, you know, the media is going to want to even things out. This is how they, you know, this is in their DNA, that they have been very, very hard on Donald Trump, and they're going to call out Democrats anytime they see them behaving in ways that they once criticized Donald Trump for, without regard to the differing circumstances, motivations, or anything else. So I knew that was going to happen, and I knew that the Democrats were going to be weak on this. And they need to not be weak. Joe Biden needs to not be weak, because we are in a crisis, and it's a multi, you know, dimensional crisis that has to do with the pandemic, the economy, climate change, inequality, you know, racial strife. And, you know, you've got, I mean, there is a lot going on, and it is really, really important that the Democrats understand that they have a job to do, and they're going to have to do it. And I'm not suggesting they break the law, I'm not suggesting they do anything that is truly unconstitutional. But because the Republicans have gone crazy and are no longer acting in good faith in any way across the board, and they are basically just power mad, you know, lunatics, the Democrats are going to have to, if they want to, you know, run the country, try and save the country, they're going to have to be strong here and not care if somebody on the Sunday morning talk show says that, you know, they're being hypocrites, and not care if, you know, not sit there and look at their, you know, the people across the aisle and go, well, you know, he's a good guy. He told me he didn't really like Trump, so I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt. They can't do that. If they do, they're going to fail. And the Republicans will, you know, the midterm in 2022 is going to be a wipeout, and 2024 will have somebody even worse than Trump in there, if not Trump himself. This is a very, very, this is a super important moment. And in hearing that Biden is telling people, you know, I know they want me to use my power this way, but it's unconstitutional, and I just don't buy that. You know, I mean, here we are. And I guess, did we expect anything else from a guy who's been in Washington since the 70s?
Probably not. But it is still infuriating. And the idea, you know, that Democrats conflate the idea of, like, we, you know, the American public rejected Donald Trump, but they did not hire essentially Democrats to go in and restore arcane procedural norms. That was not the primary purpose. They want a functioning government. They want a government that is going to actually provide material benefits for them in some fashion or another. And however people define that. And there is there is virtually no constituency out there that defines material benefit from the government as a restoration of arcane procedural norms. Those people don't exist. I mean, it could be like, you know, they want the government to do this, or they want the government to do that, or they want certain cultural, whatever it is. But it is not. People are like, finally, you know, we're not going to revive that perspective on antitrust or whatever it is. That's not what people are asking for. It is frustrating, and it is part of an overall problem that we have with the Democratic leadership, it seems to me. There was a story this week that came out in The New Yorker, written by Jane Mayer, a highly respected journalist, that Dianne Feinstein is mentally incapable of doing her job, essentially, is what it is. She's 87 years old. She apparently according to this piece, appears to be suffering steep cognitive decline. And I should say, I have a tremendous amount of sympathy for her family in this situation. I am actively going through a similar situation within the context of my family. The difference is, I know how difficult this is to manage. The implications of, in a family context or maybe at work or something, you know, going down the hall and, you know, talking to your manager and saying, you know, old Bob over there is just not, you know, weird things going on. And Bob going down there and saying like, hey, the boss going down there and saying, Bob, you need to step back from some stuff or you need to get yourself checked out or blah, blah, blah. I mean, obviously, this is a different situation because you have an elected official. But it appears that this has been going on for a couple of years. It appears that there's been knowledge that this has been going on for a couple of years. It is so bad right now that when Chuck Schumer, following up on the fact that Feinstein apparently like repeated a question to Jack Dorsey in a hearing about Twitter or social media, this is about a month ago, verbatim, back to back, didn't seem to have any sort of awareness that she had just asked that question. Chuck Schumer went and spoke to her. It's according to the Jane Mayer piece. Said you need to step down from the Judiciary Committee chairmanship. And apparently she's so bad right now that she didn't remember having the conversation. He had to have a second one. You know, this is a failure of leadership. There are 100 senators in the country. The decisions that they make, each as individuals, particularly one like Dianne Feinstein, who sits on the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, affects the lives of hundreds of millions of people. And the idea that nobody stepped up and said, maybe you shouldn't rerun for election, or in fact, if you do run for re-election, we're going to change the rules in terms of seniority, in terms of committee chairs, or we're going to support your opponent, Kevin DeLeon, who is a Democrat in California in particular, right? Like you had two Democrats running in the general election. I mean, when Amy Coney Barrett hearing started, her numbers, she entered in with a certain amount of approval rating. Those approval ratings were higher after the committee hearing. That was an abject failure by any possible metric that exists. I don't care what your opinion is to what their strategy or their tactics should have been. That is an abject failure. And the fact that Dianne Feinstein was allowed to marshal that endeavor is beyond the pale. It's beyond the pale. And we were talking about something that was 5 weeks ago, 3 weeks before Chuck Schumer had to have multiple conversations with her because she couldn't remember them. I mean,
I felt like she was, you know, obviously, you know, not her former self, going back quite a ways, but in the Kavanaugh hearings as well. And in fact, she bobbled that too.
Yeah.
And maybe you can blame her staff for this. I don't know. But whatever, it doesn't matter. That, you know, they had the letter from Christine Blasey Ford.
Yep.
For some time before it
months and months before.
There should have been a strategy, you know, to deal with that. And it kind of just came up out of the blue way, way, way into the process, which made it very, very difficult to actually, you know, create a strategy there or give enough time for, you know, to insist that the FBI investigate, all the kind of things that could have happened had they done that. So, you know, she's been incompetent in the job for a while. And, you know, you kind of have to blame her staff as well. Because I'm assuming, and I think they've been protecting her, or they don't, they're incapable of dealing with her. And, you know, this is an old story in the Senate. You know, we had Strom Thurmond walking around in his pajamas. I mean, you know, there's been a lot of things. This has gone on from the beginning, and it gets to my, and I won't digress too far on this, but I think the Senate is an undemocratic institution. I'm not for it anyway. I think it's kind of ridiculous. It puts at a disadvantage, you know, the places where the people live. instead of rocks and cows, you know, on and on and on. It's like the Electoral College. And it's kind of based on the House of Lords. I just don't like the whole concept. But since we have it and it's not going anywhere, the very least we can do is to try and make it a more responsive institution to the people. And one of the ways that you do that is by, you know, the elder statesmen that are in there. And there are a lot of them. It's not just Feinstein. I mean, she's
right.
The one who seems to be deteriorating. But, you know, Chuck Grassley isn't exactly...
Well, wait a second.
You know, Posner or what's the guy from Vermont?
Patrick Leahy.
Patrick Leahy.
Who was the last chairman of the judiciary.
Inhofe, you know, Richard Shelby. There's a bunch of them that are over 85 years old. I mean, why don't these people want to retire
out
in their rose garden? I don't get it.
But here's the thing. We should not have to rely exclusively on the egos of these senators or, frankly, the House members to address something that's very difficult maybe for them to address because they have cognitive impairment to begin with. I mean, anybody who has dealt with someone who has been in this situation understands a certain amount of denial, and that is part of the decline in and of itself. That comes baked into the cake. And, you know, we say that maybe that Dianne Feinstein is the only one who apparently has this decline. Well, we don't know that. That's the point, is that this is not a situation where, like, you know, this comes out after she has been, you know, basically told that there's not going to be institutional support and she shouldn't run for re-election in 2018. This is coming out only because we are at like red alarm, five alarm fire, and coming out through back channels, in anonymous sources, because clearly there's no one in leadership that is working on this. Like, they're waiting to the last possible moment. I mean, look, who's to say that she's the only one who's suffering from this? We have a higher number of people in their 80s in the Senate, and I would imagine the House too, than we've ever had before. We have a problem with the Democratic leadership being really stuck in a different time period, and a whole host of leaders who are all, you know, very old. I'm sorry. Like, I mean, they're old. Being old in and of itself is not necessarily a problem. But being stuck in these same positions for an extended period of time, and now with the understanding that the Democratic Party leadership has no interest in making sure that their key figures are mentally competent. I mean, that's all that we got to walk away from this, right? Is like, we don't know who else is suffering in this way. We don't know who else is incapable of representing the interest of the Democratic Party. And you know, we should also make the note that Republicans have rotating chairmanships.
Exactly. I was just going to say that.
Democrats have seniority. Now, you are incentivizing older people to stay in the Senate or in the House in the Senate way past their prime.
Mm-hmm.
You're incentivizing the same thing in the House. You are allowing these people to also have control over the process because they have, I mean, there's a self-licking ice cream cone quality of this. This is a real problem that seems to be completely ignored. And of course, it's not like we have a force at the top of the Democratic Party who's going to deal with this, because we have a very old president. I mean, this is a real problem. We have an institutional problem with the Democratic Party that goes beyond ideology, or actually maybe just it's completely divorced from ideology. I mean, this is, I think it implicates the way that they practice politics. I think it implicates, I think there may be some ideological aspects to it, but in the final analysis, I mean, I think it has ideological implications because of you know, it makes them even that much more out of touch.
Right.
And in this era, you know, you really need to be very, very out of touch to realize, to not understand the sort of the level of desperation that exists out there. But this is really just about practice, right? I mean, this is just about, you know, practicing good politics and best practices when it comes to maintaining an institution like the Democratic caucus in these two houses. And it is that we are just witnessing an abject failure.
Well, and look at the contrast. You've got on the Judiciary Committee, you had for a while there, it was Chuck Grassley and Dianne Feinstein. It was just kind of like, oh, God, you know, this is really bad. Grassley, you know, they rotate. So now they've got, you know, the newly discovered, you know, wingnuts, Lindsey Graham, who up against Dianne Feinstein. I mean, that is not even remotely a fair fight. And, you know, this is the Judiciary Committee. This is really an important committee. It's not just some, you know, backwater, you know, subcommittee about agriculture or something, not to denigrate that. But, you know, the Judiciary Committee is a big flagship committee that does very, very important work. And they've got Lindsey Graham up against Dianne Feinstein. And I know a lot of this is staff work. I know a lot of it, which, you know, this is something I mentioned this before, and I think it's important. A lot of this is staffers maintaining their own power, right?
Right.
I mean, they're in there because they've got somebody who's kind of, you know, who's slipping, and they're the ones who are actually running things, and they don't want to give that up either, right? It's a big, big problem, and I feel bad about it because I do know, you know, I mean, I feel like America has really betrayed its elderly with this pandemic. I mean, we're just basically saying, yeah, well, you know, going to lose some. What's the difference? You know, let them go. You know, even Trump said, you know, well, they were half dead anyway at one point. So, you know, there is that whole side of it of being cruel to elderly people, and you know, nobody wants that. But this is different. This is a situation where, you know, we really can't afford to do this. I mean, we are all elderly people will suffer because people are unwilling to deal with Dianne Feinstein and the rest of them. I mean, I'm for an age limit personally. I think there should be a mandatory retirement. You know, that if once you hit 80,
yep,
you can't run again. Yeah. I mean, if you're there and you just won, you were 79, okay, well, you get to go to 85 if you really need to do that. But, you know, once you hit 80, that's your last election. You don't get to run after that. I mean, I don't think that's so bad.
I don't think so
either. I mean,
people
are living longer, but, you know, retire, enjoy life. You don't have to be, you know, showing up at work every day when you're 85 years old. It's ridiculous.
Well, Heather, it's been quite a week. We will check back in next week, and hopefully we will see what happens with the stimulus bill.
Yeah, God help us. They have to fix this. We are in such deep, deep trouble if this one falls apart. And I don't think people understand how serious this really is. I don't think there's just too much going on, always so much churn in our politics these days that it's really hard to focus, but this is so huge. I mean, people are going to be desperate if they don't pass this thing.
Indeed. Heather Parton, Digby, as always, a pleasure.
Thanks for having me, Sam.
I am here with Jeff Stein, one of the best reporters out there from the Washington Post, always focuses on the right issues. Jeff, how are you today?
I'm good. Very glad to be on, and glad we could get this set up.
Yes, we had some technical difficulties, but I think this is going to be the one. Jeff has been working extremely hard covering the stimulus talks. The House yesterday passed the continuing resolution that keeps the government open. It was set to shut down on the 11th, December 11th. Everyone, you may be listening to this over the weekend, so that date may have passed. But now it seems like the government will stay open through the 18th. Now, Jeff, what is your sense about after the 18th? Because stimulus talks seem to be very far apart, much more so than I think a lot of people anticipated at this point in the process, as 1.4 million Americans filed for unemployment last week, and almost 20 million Americans are out of work officially and on unemployment.
So again, thanks for having me on, Emma, and for the kind words. I followed your work at TYT. I think this is a really complicated and fast-moving situation, and all the normal cliches you hear on the Hill. Just to break things down a little bit, by the time this airs on Saturday, I believe, right, we should have passed already a one-week extension of the federal government's ability to operate without shutting down. But by next week, leaders are hoping to be able to tack on the stimulus bill, whatever can be agreed to, on top of the bill that's required to fund the federal government. And so what a lot of people are worried about is, obviously people are very nervous that whatever Congress comes up with on a bipartisan agreement for a stimulus deal will be insufficient to the severe economic decay we're seeing accelerating right now, but also that it could complicate the government spending agreement, and that at this very, very dangerous moment for not just the American economy, but for the health and well-being of tens of millions of people, that the government would be at risk of a shutdown. Democrats are going to have a very, very tough time, I think, after they rejected and held out for a $2 trillion deal, taking what Republicans are willing to offer right now, which is really not that much money compared to what they were putting on the table back this summer and fall. But the alternative for Democrats to shut down the federal government and let all these programs expire and get nothing ahead of the winter is even a bleaker prospect from their perspective. So the stakes are incredibly high. We're coming right down to the wire. It is maddening and impossible to understand why it takes so long for these things to happen. But Pelosi today said that these negotiations could stretch on until after Christmas. So, I mean, as a Jew, that doesn't interfere with my reporting so much, but it could be a real headache to watch the next couple weeks.
Well, happy Hanukkah. We are recording this on the first night of Hanukkah. Yeah, I mean, it is maddening to me. And what I'm curious about is Pelosi didn't accept Mnuchin's $1.8 trillion deal before the election, when the White House was quite eager to get another round of stimulus checks out to Americans because they believe that it favored Trump in the election. And there is some, you know, anecdotal evidence that shows that the first round of stimulus checks was a boon to President Trump, and maybe had more of an effect than people realize, which I do understand that from a political perspective. But if McConnell wasn't going to accept that $1.8 trillion deal before the election anyway, it seems to be a severe political miscalculation on her part, in my view, now that she could have just punted it to him. And now McConnell's not even agreeing to the $908 billion plan that's being floated by the most centrist Democrats and Republicans right now that doesn't include stimulus checks and cuts unemployment insurance in half.
Yeah, the stimulus checks discussion, I feel like, is often sort of talked about in a kind of elliptical way, and yet it seems like the center of gravity for so much of the for understanding the last few months. You know, I've talked to some Democrats, senior Democratic officials, who will say in a very guarded, off-record way, and they'll kind of acknowledge this, and this is not the stated position of Democratic leadership, and they may, well, not only adamantly deny it, but genuinely not agree with this. But there are some senior Democrats who feel like it would have been political malpractice to let Trump send another round of stimulus checks right before his election. And their attitude is, you know, some of them, that Trump was a tremendous damage to the country, and allowing him to do that, allowing him to win re-election, was not worth the price. Of course, the flip side of that is now tens of millions of people are staring at the precipice. We have 30 million people on the brink of eviction. Hunger has gone up by about five times. And the critics of the Democratic Party's approach here have said that, you know, they've put politics, and this is the Republican attitude at least, have they put politics above the vast immiseration of working class Americans. I will just say on the politics, there was an amazing story in Bloomberg that I encourage your listeners to check out if they get a chance, about how in Brazil, it's a bit of a tangent from my beat, and I'm talking a little out of turn here, but in Brazil, Jair Bolsonaro sent out a version of the stimulus checks. It was a much smaller amount than we got here, but it gave a financial lifeline to tens of millions of Brazilians in deep poverty. And now we've seen, because in Brazil, I guess you can put a nickname down for yourself when you run for office, that tons of down ballot candidates across Brazil are now just calling themselves Bolsonaro, because in large part the stimulus checks made him so popular with the rural poor, because it was such an incredible infusion of capital in a way that nobody had seen before to the working class. And it's a similar effect in some ways here, where, you know, I've never seen anything in my young journalism career that you see such a visceral immediate impact, where there's a cultural phenomenon based around a government economic policy in a way that I think is exceptionally rare, from people that you hear at, you know, on the streets talking about it, to TikTok videos of 55-year-old women like trying to twerk on a image of Trump for their stimulus check. Like, it is a viral sensation and a cultural phenomenon, these checks, because they made such a huge impact. 10 million people pulled out of poverty, according to the Nonpartisan Tax Policy Center. So it was a very interesting, and I think we're going to have to continue to assess what that decision was like on the Democratic side, and the odds of another round of stimulus checks looks pretty grim right now.
Well, certainly. I mean, but the weird part of it is, say in some wonderful world, the Democrats, that's my view, take back both Senate seats in Georgia, right? And then it's a 50-50 split, and then Manchin would be the kingmaker there and would be the decider, to borrow Bush's term, on the stimulus checks there pretty much, right? And then, in my ideal world, they would pass another round of stimulus checks after those Senate seats were potentially won, and then Biden would get that political capital that Trump got. But Pelosi seems to be completely disregarding the prospect of stimulus checks, because the White House is now proposing, oh, we'll give you half of that, $600 in stimulus checks, but no unemployment insurance whatsoever, which is obviously a non-starter. You don't, once you get into power from a political perspective, from a tactical perspective, offer less than when the opposition party had the president in power, because of that very dynamic that you're talking about here, Jeff. Like, it is a political boon. It is a plus for the president to be sending out these kinds of stimulus checks. You should be more robust when you're in power. I mean, Republicans have known this forever. They'll drive up the debt and the deficit when they're in power, and then they'll try to limit the spending of the Democratic president when the Democrat's in power. So it's a long way of saying I'm not quite sure what the strategy is behind this, except for the fact that Democrats do not have the political capital that they thought they would, based on the lack of gains in the Senate and the House, you know, losing seats.
You're asking about, like, the Democratic play here, right?
Yes.
I think the important thing to understand, and Jim Tankersley of the New York Times did a great job sort of getting this out, that very sort of subtly, and really almost imperceptibly, the Biden people sort of quietly indicated that they want a deal, just something, because they are trying to mitigate the disaster that they're going to inherit when they come to office, and they're very worried about what the first few months of a Biden administration could look like if there's literally no additional help from the federal government. But at the same time they did that, they knew that they couldn't, or at least they didn't want to, publicly undercut the Pelosi-Schumer position. And so as a result, you saw these sort of careful leaks that indicated that the Biden people want to get something done, but didn't sort of throw Pelosi and Schumer under the bus for the negotiating strategy for the last few months. Pelosi has fielded a number of questions from reporters about, you know, you were holding out for over $2 trillion in the summer and fall. Why are you okay with $908 billion, which is the framework that she backed? Why are you okay with that now? And her answer has been that the two key differences are that Biden will take the virus more seriously, so the need for a bigger package is diminished, and that we've had positive vaccine news, and that therefore there's this, like, light at the end of the tunnel. I think skeptics of that would point out, you know, that the vaccine news has been there for a long time, and
vaccines don't pay your rent. I will be that skeptic and say that. I mean,
yeah, I mean, I think there's an idea that maybe Biden will be better at containing the vaccine, and therefore the economic pain will be smaller. But the reality is, like, most of the decisions about the economy are going to be driven, you know, primarily by the states and the governors. It's not really going to be up to Biden. And the fate of the virus is going to be really bad under Biden, just as it was probably going to be really bad under Trump. And to deny that politics had anything to do with the democratic considerations here, some people at least would be skeptical of that notion.
Yes, I will be very skeptical of that. And I don't like participating in fictions where everybody knows. It's just a farce. Everybody knows that they were afraid to send out a second round of stimulus checks, and Pelosi didn't take a massive deal offered to her by the White House based on those political considerations, because she was afraid McConnell would actually pass it, I guess. And that's me saying that. But back to McConnell, because the thing he's hanging his hat on is the liability shield, right? So it doesn't seem like there's going to be any legislation that passes with stimulus checks at all, but really with any unemployment help either, or money for states and cities, which is really under reported, not by you, but it's incredibly needed, without this liability shield. And I think a lot of people may think they know what it means, but they may not know fully to the extent what the liability shield entails. So can you explain that?
Yes. The liability shield, as proposed by McConnell and Senator John Cornyn of Texas, would effectively immunize corporations, but also charities, nonprofits, universities. They sort of added those later, I think skeptics would say, in order to make the liability shield seem more politically palatable and not just to give away for big businesses. It would effectively, except for in the cases of gross negligence, protect these firms and other entities from lawsuits from consumers and workers who feel like they were exposed recklessly to the coronavirus and got sick as a result. The argument from Republicans has been that this is a new area of litigation, that businesses, you know, were not reasonably prepared for this kind of thing, and that the trial lawyers, which they say control the Democratic Party, are completely unwilling to allow this to come to pass, even though it's a common sense reform to protect businesses from ambulance, you know, chasing lawyers and the chintzy attorneys like you hear on the radio. That said, I think when you actually look at some of the data here, the Republicans have been warning about a flood of sort of frivolous litigation from business, from workers, advocates, and other trial attorneys. And that really hasn't materialized. And in fact, the biggest flood of coronavirus-related legal complaints that we've seen has actually been from businesses against other businesses and insurance companies. And notably, the McConnell-Cornyn proposal does not include immunization from lawsuits from those entities. So, and that's a pretty strong situation there, where you have companies saying, look, I was expecting this contract to come through, and it didn't because of COVID, and they're suing as a result, or they're taking lawsuits against other companies for not protecting them from some unexpected COVID-related event. And that has not been a sticking point, and that's not even in the COVID liability shield that McConnell has talked about.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, it seems like it's more proactive than anything, since there isn't the flood of cases that you're talking about. And it also seems redundant based on the stripping of protections for workers that the Trump administration has already, and the Republican Party have already, implemented.
And I'll just say, to give the other side here a little bit, from the Republican perspective, the lack of a flood of litigation, it almost cuts against the Democratic argument as well. I mean, it cuts against the Republican argument, because it's like, why do the companies need this if these lawsuits aren't materializing? But from the Democratic perspective, it's almost, you know, why do we need to maintain this civil legal protection if nobody really is availing themselves of it right now, or very few people are? And the Democrats might say, look, that's because the legal barriers for everyday workers to seek legal recourse are far too high. And that might be a legitimate claim. But, you know, the price of not approving this could be unemployment benefits for tens of millions of people, badly needed aid for, you know, states and cities that are laying off thousands of transit workers and teachers. And so, is this really so unacceptable to the Democratic Party that they are unwilling, that they're willing to let all these other programs expire because they're so unwilling to give on this, when most workers aren't really even availing themselves of the option? And, I mean, it's an uncomfortable argument to make, especially for progressive Democrats, because nobody wants to be seen, and I think understandably, as, you know, being in the pocket of the Chamber of Commerce or supporting big business. And maybe some people watching this will, you know, accuse me of being like mainstream media stooge, but I think that's like a real consideration that people are trying to wrestle with.
No, you're far from that. And I totally understand. I mean, a compromise is going to have to be made. And it seems like, at least right now, the liability shield is quite likely to be in any compromise bill that could ever happen. I mean, Mitt Romney is saying that his form of the compromise liability shield would be that it would just extend through the rest of 2020, which to me seems like, okay, I mean, there's a few weeks left. I don't understand why that would affect anything except would it be retroactive? Like if
if you know, I think the one that the workers advocates that I speak to the most bring up a lot is particularly like the meat packing plants where a ton of people got sick and
Tyson,
a ton of people died.
They were taking bets apparently, right?
Yeah, there's been a lot of ugly stuff to be alleged and to have happened at a number of large agricultural firms in particular. And the idea that all of that, where these companies were making large profits at potential worker expense, that they will be completely scot-free if there's a future legal case, I think is probably one of the more compelling arguments against laying down on the liability shield. That said, I mean, I think it's really worth pointing out, I'm sure many of your listeners already know this, but this is not a situation where, you know, we have sort of a status quo that can be maintained with no action. The series of cascading economic effects that we're staring down for, you know, vast number of working people over the next months, if there's no bill, are really quite shocking. You know, 12 million people losing unemployment benefits, 30 million people at risk of evictions, tens of millions of people, I think over 50 million people I saw at risk of having their utility shut off. And that's a very scary number. 80 million plus people are currently benefiting from a paid family leave benefit that's set to expire. So it's the scales here are not like, why don't we just do nothing and then the hold set. There's like a cliff that like Wile E. Coyote were like off of already. And like how steep is that drop going to be? Like, can we get a trampoline or some cushions under it at some point? I think it's like is really worth keeping in mind and not just thinking that if they do nothing, then things are going to stay the way they are. We're looking at such a tremendous spike in cases. The number of, as you mentioned at the top, the number of jobless claims is really accelerating in a scary way. So all things to consider.
Yeah, I mean, and we're seeing people forced to pay rent on credit cards at a number we haven't seen before. Just massive proportions of Americans behind on their rent and housing payments. And the cascading effects, as you say, are could irreparably harm human beings and also the long-term health of the economy in the United States. So it's nothing to toy around with. Last question. Really, what is your prediction? I think there are so many moving parts. As I said, Georgia is so key, and we'll find out at the beginning of January. Likely, I mean, it might take a while to count some of the votes, but who is going to be in those two Senate seats, and if we will have a 50-50 split with Kamala Harris as the tiebreaker, or if Republicans will retain the majority, which I think could really throw a wrench in any potential progress in the Biden administration. So, based on the next few weeks and the rest of 2020, do you think something will be passed? And what do you anticipate it will contain? I bet it will contain the liability shield, potentially the $300 extension of unemployment. Do you agree with that? And no stimulus checks? That's kind of my sense of it.
I remember this July I tweeted something like I expect a bill to be put to a vote in a couple weeks. That was really wrong, and so I feel like my predictive capacity is not great. Shout out to MBET that called all of the elections perfectly in 2016. But I think on the question of what I predict happening, I think what is most likely at this point is they will tack on the most sort of bipartisan, slimmed down measure. So no liability shield. Maybe only limited UI, maybe some small thing on state and local, and they'll add that to the government spending bill and pass that, but it'll be a lot smaller than the $900 billion package we're looking at. I have no idea who's going to win the Georgia elections and haven't honestly been following the polls that closely
no
anyway.
One does.
Seems like, what's the point? But I will say, like, the Biden team has been sending out these tweets that's like, help is on the way. You know, like, hang on, relief is coming. And, you know, I understand that there's like political communications incentives maybe for saying those kinds of things. But like, I don't think they know if that's true, because we don't know what's going to happen with the Senate. And we don't know what McConnell would do if Republicans keep the Senate. And So, it, I mean, you know, it's very possible that there's a deal that Democrats can reach with McConnell, that he'll be willing to do that. My sense is from the Republican sources I talked to are that McConnell actually like does want to do something. I think he thinks he has the leverage now, which I think he does. And I think he thinks that what Democrats want is unnecessary, but he certainly wants to do small business aid. He's shown an openness to some versions of UI at various points. So, you know, maybe he'll play ball and there are indications that he wants to do something, but the idea that like Biden's going to get sworn in and we're going to do a $3 trillion stimulus seems to take a lot of sort of logical leaps that I don't know how anyone can be assured of.
Yeah, I would not bet on that. Jeff Stein of the Washington Post, truly just follow his work if you want to be up to date on everything regarding the stimulus and budget negotiation talks. Thanks so much, Jeff.
Can you tell your followers to stop asking me about their checks?
Yeah, please. Stop asking Jeff about your checks.
You heard it here first.
Representative, reach out to your senator, not Jeff. Jeff is not in charge, even though he knows everything about them.
Thanks, Emma. Now I will be obliged to come back on whenever you want.
Okay, so awesome. Thanks so much for coming.
Thanks a lot, Emma. Bye.
Right, thanks, bye.
That's it for another week of Ring of Fire. Are you still subscribed to our free show? Well, head over to rofpodcast.com. Do us both a favor. Support the show by becoming a member. You can follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can watch our videos on YouTube. You can go to ringoffireradio.com to find out more. And check out my daily show, The Majority Report. Head over to majority.fm daily for a live stream at noon. I'm joined by Emma on all those programs. You can check out in-depth interviews and the biggest news stories of the day. I'm Sam Cedar. This has been Ring of Fire.